Welcome, everybody. This is the fourth lecture in our course on women in Indian Buddhism, organized by the Numata Center of Buddhist Studies and the Women in Buddhism Study Initiative at the University of Hamburg. And today it is my great pleasure to welcome Nalini Balbir, who will be speaking to us on the topic of women roles in the Jain tradition. Nalini Balbir, of French Indian origin, is professor of Indian studies at the University of Paris Trois Sorbonne Nouvelle and of Middle Indian philology, especially Pali, at the École Pratique des Hautes Études de Paris. She has a long-standing interest in Indian languages, Sanskrit, Middle Indic, Hindi and Gujarati, and in all aspects of Jain studies. She has published extensively in this field, focusing on narratives as a media of teaching and on the early commentaries. She has also contributed to the Critical Pali Dictionary. In recent years, she has been involved actively in cataloging Jain manuscripts in various European collections, especially in London and Cambridge, and has been working as chief editor of Jainpedia, a collaborative educational resource online which combines descriptions of Jain manuscripts and encyclopedia articles on various topics. A full list of her publications is available on the website of the research group UMR 7528, Monde Iranien et Indien, of which she is a member. And with this, I hand over to Nalini Balbir.
So thank you very much, Bhikkhu Annalayo, for this kind introduction. And good afternoon to everybody. So the purpose of my lecture today is mainly to make you hear the voices of the Jains on women, calling on occasional comparisons with the Buddhist tradition, especially as expressed in Pali sources. I will not really give a background of Jainism in this lecture, because there was a background given very nicely in the lecture of last week, which you can hear anyway if you want more details. So there are at least two immediate reasons that could justify an exploration of women's roles, specifically in the Jain tradition. One is that from the historical start in the 6th century BCE, at least, Jainism has given a specific place to women within its doctrinal system. As lay followers engaged in the life of society supportive of the teaching, but also as nuns or female renouncers. Thus, women form an integral part of the fourfold community, Sangha, a term which is used among Jains too, along with male lay followers and monks. And two, from the first statistical data available in early texts until today, the number of both nuns and female lay followers has always outnumbered that of their male counterparts. The high number of nuns has been considered as striking, given the patriarchal and male-dominant Indian environments where Jains have lived, and the Jain tradition has been seen as rather unique from this perspective. Here, you see an example of a very positive and enthusiastic statement on the view of female roles in this tradition, expressed by an Indian Jain scholar. I quote, "The role of women in Jain religion has been very progressive and ennobling on the whole. As mothers, they have given birth to Tirthankaras. As wives, they have provided inspiration to their husbands. As individuals, they have managed large trade and commerce independently. In the Jain way of life, women has always forever been honored everywhere. Sadhvis have set an example for the society in matters relating to the ultimate achievement of spiritual progress. The liberation of women, the freedom of women, and the advancement of women are integrated in Jain religion. These principles are sure to guide and lead the people in the ensuing decades towards the new path of attainment of the liberty of women." End of quote. So this statement is very enthusiastic and has, in such statements, have led some to speak of Jainism as an indigenous feminism. But anyway, they have the advantage of underlining some of the key issues or prevailing features relating to women's roles among Jains. So what I will do today with you is to explore some of these roles with reference to texts, including stories and art depiction. I will draw on canonical sources written in Prakrit, a variety of Middle Indic, or in Sanskrit to discuss the following points which you see before you. So women in general, non-portraits, women as donors, and construction of gender in mythology along with related issues. In order to rightly understand the originality of Jainism with respect to the women's status, one should bear in mind that this tradition shares all the same despising beliefs about them that other Indian traditions in particular have. But on the other hand, it shows high care to integrate them in the ethical and spiritual patterns which are characteristic of its own tradition. There are general statements and points of view in the sources. There are the monastic rules which are definitely more restrictive for nuns than for monks, but there are also exceptions and counter-examples so that the picture we have is complex. The Jains have also laid more emphasis on women's roles other than being a nun and have systematically ascribed them a place within their general religious setting. This, I think, may distinguish them from the Buddhists. So today I will tackle some of the most significant features or challenging issues regarding the place of women within the Jain tradition. For that, texts written by the Jain themselves are the obvious source, but the early Jain communities were not alone in the Indian religious landscape. In particular, Buddhists were there too, as competing for support from businessmen or other social groups. And Buddhists and Jains looked at each other. There were Buddhist monastic orders and Jain monastic orders. And we have instances showing that one could get initiated into one tradition and then shift to the other one. This was the case of Bhadda Kundala Kesa, whose voice is heard through a poem of the Theri Gatha. I quote, "With hair plucked out, wearing dust, formerly I wandered, having only one robe, thinking there was a fault where there was no fault, and seeing no fault where there was a fault. Going out from my daytime resting place on Mount Gijjakuta, I saw the stainless Buddha, attended by the order of bhikkhus. Having bent the knee, having paid homage to him, I stood with cupped hands, face to face with him. 'Come, Bhadda,' he said to me. That was my ordination." So what Bhadda depicts at first is her earlier life in negative terms. The term Jain is not there, but the practices described clearly point to Jain practices. In particular, "with hair plucked out," Luna Kesi in Pali, refers to the distinctive Jain gesture signifying ordination into the Jain order, in contrast with the Buddhist phrase Kappakena Kesamasuni Oharapetva. Plucking out the hair is also said in Pali scriptures of the Ajivika Jambuka, implying that this practice could have been current among Jains and Ajivikas as well. Whether a monk or nun, the future Jain ascetic indeed performs this symbolic gesture himself. And here, see how it depicted in a map printing of the medieval period. You see here the monk plucking out the hair himself with the hand. Of course, I would have liked to show you a nun doing, but although nuns are not excluded from representation, it is clear that they have a much less sustained presence in art than their male counterparts. Well, to return to Bhadda Kundala Kesa, Dhammapala's commentary on the Theri Gatha passage dating back to the 6th century CE is also interesting, for it shows awareness of how the plucking out was performed. He says that ashes are spread at the root of the hair before they are plucked out with fingers. This is how it is done even today and how it is described also in Jain sources. Further, Dhammapala also introduces Bhadda the Jain nun with the designation Nigganti, which is the technical term in use in Jain sources as well. And he describes her as a lady of power who was able to debate with the best Jain master. This is, however, not for her praise, as she is, by contrast, not capable to answer a simple question put to her by Sariputta, and this is what determines her to convert to Buddhism. In Dhammapala's eyes, it is surely also a way to present Jains as people who perhaps spend too much time in irrelevant discussions and should rather apply their talents in other ways. But now to the Jain sources themselves. So the Jain teachings, as you will know, were first transmitted orally from teacher to disciple through successive generations. We can note in passing that women are not ascribed any role in this transmission. The texts that praise the early teachers, disciples of Mahavira and disciples of his disciples, and simultaneously hand down the early history of the Jain church, or what is called the Sthaviravali, show exclusively male spiritual genealogies. Similarly, the work which records the sayings of 45 sages called Isi, the Isi Bhasiyayim, some of whom are known from the Brahmanic and Buddhist traditions, do not include any women among them. As we have them, the Shvetambara canonical scriptures were collected and put down to writing in the middle of the 5th century CE. But despite this collation, all the texts and even all the sections within a text are not necessarily of the same age. This has to be kept in mind, even if the question is difficult or impossible to solve really. What we see is that the Jain tradition does not know of any account which would show that the idea of a nun's order could have caused any difficulty. So, for example, here you see a representation, of course, much later than the early texts in the medieval painting, but it shows the Chaturvidha Sangha, fourfold Jain community, and the nuns are shown here, along with here the monks, the lay women, and the laymen. So there is nothing in Jain sources like the reluctance present in Pali Buddhist sources, which has given rise to so many discussions in scholarship as well. Nuns were always there as part of the fourfold Sangha, and concern for giving statistics about the monastic communities gathered around the Jinas is there in the Kalpa Sutra, a text which is central to the Shvetambara tradition. On the other hand, the disciplinary texts, the Cheda Sutras, comparable to the Vinayas, do give monastic rules for both monks and nuns systematically. But in contrast, it is striking that many scriptures do not feature nuns either individually or collectively. For example, in the first section of the first canonical text, the Acharanga Sutra, which is supposed to be very old, the masculine gender is used exclusively. The reason may be that this text does not have in focus the ascetic as a member of a community, but the ascetic wandering alone, the ideal figure being that of Mahavira, wandering alone amongst hostile serenity. Here, the imagery is that of the male hero rather than of the ordinary mendicant living in a group. And this is an instance of a definitely male-oriented text. In this context, women are present only in outbursts of ascetic misogyny as representing a threat to peacefulness of mind, like the passage you see here. Wisely reject hope and desire, and expecting that thorn, thou should act rightly. The world is greatly troubled by women. Men forsooth say, these are the vessels of happiness, but this leads them to pain, to delusion, to death, to hell, to birth, as hell beings or brute beasts. The five great vows, with Mahavratas, which are meant for mendicants and form the essentials of right conduct are seen only from the male angle, as is clear in the phrasing of the fourth vow about celibacy, the most crucial one and the most difficult to observe. You have the wording in front of you. A Nirgrantha does not continually discuss topics relating to women. He does not regard and contemplate the lovely forms of women. He does not recall to his mind the pleasures and amusements he formerly had with women. This prohibition is conceptualized in the generic term Prakrit Ittikaha, talks about women, which forms one of the four prohibited types of talks, Vikaha. This would mean talking about women's family, about their body and beauty, and about their clothes. Another famous canonical lecture called Itti Parinna, Knowledge and Discernment about Women, is entirely devoted to warn the monk against all possible dangers coming from women as temptresses and dominating, the only remedy being simply to avoid seeing them at all. This amounts to a very detailed and rather realistic description of the female arsenal of seduction and of all the traps they may create with no limit to their resources and imagination. Among these female weapons is their deceptive wish to follow the monk's rule. For instance, they could go up to propose, "Oh monk, if you will not live with me as a woman who has still her hair, I shall tear it out, but do not live separated from me," as the text says. So male mendicants predominantly feature as always in need of encouragements and warnings in order to remain on the path. We can contrast this with the canonical depiction of the figure of Rajimati. Rajimati was born as a princess, and she was to marry Prince Arishtanemi. But he, a future Jinnah, gave up the idea of marrying when he saw numerous animals kept in cages and enclosures ready to be slaughtered for the wedding feast. Then the princess thought, "Shame upon my life that I have been forsaken by him. It is better I should turn nun." Now, when she had taken shelter from heavy rain in a cave, after having become a nun, and when she had removed her clothes to dry them, thus naked as a newborn baby, she happened to be seen by her brother-in-law, the monk Ratanemi, who tried to invite her to enjoy pleasure with him, in terms which remind of Mara proposing to the Bhikkhuni Vijaya, in the Pali Bhikkhuni Samyutta, for instance. But Rajimati, true to self-control and her vows, maintained the honor of her clan and family and her virtue. She rejected Ratanemi's offer. Not only that, she also taught him what proper conduct should be, putting him to shame. So in this story, the nun is clearly portrayed as superior to the monk and as an able teacher. As the text says, having heard these well-spoken words of the virtuous lady, Ratanemi returned to the law like an elephant driven by the hook, and then practiced true monkhood. Rajimati, indeed, is a role model for nuns even today, as she is the embodiment of chastity challenged by a man, and utterly victorious because of her own resolve, which in addition has the power of convincing her challenger. Canonical Jain story literature also provides vivid portraits of nuns, of their lives and of their difficulties. Some of the situations described, the reactions or the motivations, are echoed by today's ethnographic fieldwork and interviews. And so, even if these stories are not sociological documents, they can be read as conveying important concerns and not as pure fictions. They are of particular importance in the Jain tradition, and among canonical sutras, there are books that are entirely made of narratives. For instance, we encounter characters who put forward issues relating to motivations for entering mendicant life and compatibility between ascetic life and femininity. I now discuss one such story, from the Niraya Valika Sutra, the Puspika Upanga. There was in Benares one Subhadra who enjoyed a happy married life with her husband, but she was depressed as she had not given birth to any child and found her life useless for this reason. She describes her suffering in very precise terms. I quote, "Complete is the life as humans of those mothers, and blessed, fortunate, and meritorious are those mothers who have given birth to a child, who breastfeed their own child who is eager to suckle, who sweetly stutters, and who in stupor shifts from the base of the breasts toward the armpit, who have heard the sweet stutter of the child and comforted it by hugging, and who have lifted the baby with their tender and loving hands, placed it in the lap, and enjoyed sweet and loving talk with the baby. But I am the wretched and ill-fated one that has been deprived of any of these pleasures of an offspring." End of quote. Now, a nun called Subrata, who is described as practicing all rules perfectly, and is accompanied by a group of female disciples, happens to come to Benares and visits Subhadra's house in search for alms. This is an occasion for interaction and dialogue. The lady in pain sees in the nun a potential and experimented advisor and asks her for remedies of all kinds. As a dutiful nun, she replies that she cannot propose any medical or magical treatment, but can only preach the Jain law. As a result, Subhadra takes the vows of a Jain laywoman first, and now spends her life observing them. But her original suffering remains, and she finally asks her husband the permission to give up worldly life and to become a nun. In the traditional way, the husband first refuses, but finally accepts when he sees no other solution. The ordination ceremony is organized in great pomp, and Subhadra's husband intervenes to explain that he has always cared for his wife, whom he offers as a disciple to the nuns. A nun she becomes then, but her longing for children remains. She develops affection for children and of householders and becomes a nannying nun. She started searching and bringing a variety of things for these children. Of these adolescents, kids and babies, she would massage some with oil, rub paste to some, give bath with clean water to some, paint legs and lips of some, apply collyrium to eyes of some, make arrow-like figure with saffron at the center of the foreheads of some, and rock some in a rocker. She would also make some kids stand in a line and then make them stand apart for applying sandalwood paste to some and perfumed powder to others. To some she would give dolls to play with, to some she would feed sweets, and to some she would feed or milk with milk rice. She would take off garland from neck of some and shower flowers on them. Some she would place on both the legs and others on her thighs. She would lovingly cuddle and fondle babies, lifting some on her legs, some in her arms, some on her waist, some on her back, some on her breasts, some on her shoulders, some on her head, and some in her palms. Smooching them, she would sing lullabies to some and songs in loud voice to others. This way, she spent her time with children, vicariously satiating her desire for son, wish for a daughter, and craving for grandchildren. End of quote. So, of course, she was blamed by other nuns, but did not pay attention to their reproach. Instead, she thought she had more freedom when she was a laywoman, left her monastic group, and settled on her own, continuing to interact with children. Finally, she left ascetic virtues and indulged in laxity. In one of her next rebirths, she will be cured from this obsession with children after she will have given birth to a lot of them who would make her life very hard, as a result of which she will again turn to monastic life, this time leading it properly. So what does this story say? In particular, it has evidenced how becoming a nun is seen as a solution to insatisfaction with worldly life, rather than a decision with positive motivations. but it takes care to insist on the fact that the reason was not unhappy relations with the husband. Another canonical story, on the other hand, relates how a woman turned to ascetic life after having been rejected by her husband and having remarried, this having happened several times. In such cases, becoming a nun is indeed an attempt at escaping the world, to quote the title of a recent book on Jain nuns in the 20th century. And unhappiness in married life is indeed one of the most frequent motivations they mention. But similar texts also provide instances of young girls who wish to take initiation without having experienced troubles in life, just because they have been in contact with preaching nuns. This situation is also prevalent in today's Jain Simal monasticism, where the number of non-married young ladies becoming nuns has been growing along the years. The permanent and prolonged interaction with mendicants over formative years of their lives is a reality which is also underlined in monastic autobiographies from various backgrounds. And an instance which one can read easily is, would be the account of one Arika Prasannamati, a Digambara nun, who narrated her life to William Dalrymple in his book Nine Lives. And she explains how, at the age of 13, she was impressed by the teachings of a Digambara monk, saying, "It did not take long before I decided I wanted to be like him. His words and his teachings totally changed my life." End of quote. But Subhadra's story shows also pedagogically that entry into monastic life does not help if the woman is unable to overcome psychological hindrances. Her life as a nun is a failure. One reason of such failures, described in other stories, is a certain incompatibility between ascetic life and femininity. A recurring motif is that of nuns concerned by their beauty or by body care, which amounts to transgressing rules of restraint. Those who commit this fault would wash all parts of their body many times, or would sprinkle water over the ground they use for standing, sleeping, meditating, or studying. And when they are reproached by their superiors, the justification they give is that nuns are those who cleanse their inner impurities and thus that they are strictly celibate. But indulging in excessive care for the body meant to make it more attractive is an invitation to potential viewers, and thus it's a virtual breaking of the vow of chastity. Indeed, Jain monastic regulations take all precautions to have nuns conceal any physical attractiveness. This aim is achieved in particular by a full outfit made of several pieces of cloth, so that the femininity is not prominent and the nun is protected from male aggression with a true armor. On this picture, from an 18th century manuscript, we are among Digambaras. So the monks, the munis, considered to be spiritually the most advanced members of the religious community, go naked, and you see some of them here. And nakedness means complete detachment and indifference to the body and to external reactions. This is why it is reserved only for advanced monks. The two white-clad figures, which you see on the picture, are two young mendicants, Abhaya Ruchi and Abhaya Mati. The first one is a boy, and the second a girl. But it is rather difficult to distinguish between them, as what is more striking is the layer of clothes that cover their bodies. It is more important in the painter's view to identify them as mendicants than to know their sex, or than to identify the girl among them by any sign. Indeed, if not clothed properly, a nun would put her chastity at risk, independently of her own determination. This is what we have seen in the story of Rajimati, which I discussed earlier, and which you see an illustration here. The painters obviously avoided deliberately showing her nude when she is taking shelter in the cave. She is shown here. You see here how this painter has negotiated the question of nudity not being shown. In fact, nuns never protect themselves enough and are exposed to a lot of dangers. One of the most famous examples is that of the nun Saraswati. Her kidnapping sets on the plot that makes the story of Kalakacharya known in several versions and often illustrated in manuscript paintings. And you have it, one example here. So Prince Kalaka, after having heard a monk's sermon, decides to become a monk and is allowed to do so by his parents. He soon becomes a renowned teacher whose preaching is well attended. As it would happen today as well, a group of nuns joins the audience to listen to him. Among them is, by reason of her virtues and beauty preeminent among all women, diligently observing all the duties of nuns, the younger sister of the teacher Kalaka, the nun Saraswati. But as she was going out to the latrine, she is seen by Gardabhila, the king of Ujjaini, and he has her forcibly cast into his harem against her will, while she cries out, "Alas, good master, alas, brother, alas, master of the faith, Kalaka, chief of monks, save for me the treasure of righteous living of which I am being robbed by the base king." As despite all attempts at persuasion, the king refuses to set the nun free, Kalaka takes an oath that he will uproot this king who has offended the Jain faith through this miserable act. This is why later he goes to the king of the Sahi, allies with him, gets supplies by magically transforming bricks into gold, prepares a siege of Ujjaini, annihilates the king's magic spells, catches him as a prisoner, and finally frees the nun who was re-established in the restraints. Kalaka explains to the wicked king, "Because you violated a nun against her will and did not respect the congregation, therefore I have done this. Whatever man with mind deluded by mighty delusion destroys a nun's virtue, he lays a fire at the root of the prophet arising from the enlightenment of Jain religion." Several significant points come out of this story. The abduction takes place when the nun is far from the group in a deserted place. Loneliness, indeed, is not allowed to nuns who have to be in groups. Even this actually may not be sufficient. In another version of the story, the nun is kidnapped, although she is accompanied by other nuns. The episode shows that religious initiation may be a family matter. The nun Saraswati is the sister of the monk Kalaka, and in some versions of the story, it is told that both entered religious life together. This is a fact common today, as now family ties are theoretically no longer present when members of the same family have become mendicants. In practice, they remain special in other ways. In our story, the nun comes to listen to her former brother preach. Kalaka does not put forward his status as a brother as a motivation for his action. But the nun, however, does refer to him as a brother when she pitifully cries during the kidnapping. This underlines that nuns, indeed, need monks to protect them, something which is supposing monastic rules. Nuns' safety is a matter that cannot be guaranteed by themselves alone. A monk's assistance is required in ways that have to be negotiated delicately. This assistance is a matter of solidarity as human value, but not only that. There is a solidarity of all members of the Sangha because, as statements uttered by Kalaka indicate, the assault to even one individual is a blemish to the community as a whole. One of the main concerns of the Jain regulations is to ensure that the community is not suspected of wrong behavior by society outside. If religious authority embodied by monks would not react to the a sword called to a nun, it could mean that they suspect her of being guilty or having encouraged this assault, and this would be avoided at all costs. The Jain community is viewed as a closely tied group. Any fault of one has a repercussion on all. There is also the idea of extended responsibility in the hierarchical context. Those who are higher in the hierarchy, the monks, are responsible for those who are subordinate, the nuns. Now I leave the nuns to describe a specific Jain laywoman role that has been emphasized in the tradition, her role as donor. Actually, one of the main identity markers of Jain society, whether in the past or today, is the respect of dietary rules, which are rather elaborate. Practice, but also text and manuscript paintings, provide ample evidence on the key role played by Jain laywomen, Sravikas, in this process. In charge of cooking, they are the guardians of the tradition for family members within the home, and this is obviously important in the Indian context, but also today in the countries where the Jain diaspora is settled, as vegetarianism is strongly challenged by the outside environment and is viewed as a key issue in the transmission of values to young Jains. Now, in the Indian context, the main responsibility of the laywomen is to prepare food that could be acceptable to mendicants who exclusively live on alms that they collect every day, though this food would not be specially meant for them. So in Jain localities today, monks or nuns entering houses in search for alms are a common sight. One has to be ready for this possibility. Correct fulfillment of this hospitality role implies that the women masters a minute sequence of actions and rules. In the normative texts, they are detailed and seem to be very restrictive because they want to take into account a broad spectrum of situations which in practice are not necessarily met with together. So when they describe the donor, these texts always use the feminine gender because, as the commentator remarks, the woman is the one who mostly offers alms. This role is prominent already in canonical scriptures delineating monastic rules, and you have a passage in front of you. If a woman of the house wastes the food when distributing it, the monks should refuse it, saying to the almsgiver, "I may not accept such alms." When he notices that she crushes living beings, seeds and plants with her foot, he should avoid such a house, knowing that she performs that which is not suitable to his self-control. She brings food and drink, having put her hand into the vessel, and pours out that which was inside. In all these cases, he should refuse. If she brings food and drink, having put down her crying boy or girl, to whom she is giving the breast, that food and drink is not allowed. So what we see is that within the context of very much male-oriented texts, where very often the masculine exclusively is used, in cases where the process of getting alms is described, the lady comes into the picture and the feminine gender as well. So here you see now two pictures showing such scenes of alms offering by lay women. This painting is located in a text portion of the Kalpa Sutra, which deals with monastic regulations proper for the rainy season. The lady is shown holding a ladle to serve the food. She stands under the roof of a pavilion, and the monk is standing not directly on the ground to avoid crushing minute living beings who are numerous during the monsoon, but on the top of a small plank. The selection of a scene pertaining to almsgiving to stand for all the rules prescribed by the text is easy to understand. Given the centrality of this daily event in the lives of mendicants and laypeople, it functions as a proper representative of rules as a whole. Moreover, whereas most of the prescriptions of this text are internal to mendicants, relating to their behavior towards one another, receiving food is the main area where the interaction with lay people is emphasized. So the pair, lady as donor and monk as receiver, adequately symbolizes the bonds uniting the Sangha. Women play a key role in the preservation. This picture is much more recent, from the 18th century, and is in ordinary style of painting, but it shows again ordinary Jain lay women offering food to a group of two monks, two begging monks, Shvetambara monks in their white robe and holding their danda. So the centrality of this women's role and of the concept of food offering is now further demonstrated by the following fact. The ladies mentioned by name as the chief nun of Mahavira's community and as his chief female lay disciple in the Kalpa Sutra, along with the statistics, both distinguished themselves by offering food precisely at crucial times in Mahavira's life. Chandana, the chief nun, was the only one who could understand by herself that Mahavira had taken a specific resolution regarding the food he would accept in order to break his 6 months fast. And thus, she was the only one who was able to offer the proper food in the proper circumstances. As for Revati, the chief female lay disciple, she was the one who gave the food proper to cure Mahavira from the fever which had been caused by the attack of his rival Makkali Gosala, the Ajivika teacher. So it is not by chance that these two ladies are singled out, because they were both at one point of time lady donors to monk by excellence in the form of Mahavira. In contrast with such exemplary behaviors stand the women who unwillingly perform their duty as a donor, putting the life of the begging monk in danger. And this is also a recurring motif, underlining the importance of this woman's role in the crucial interaction that almsgiving represents, and there are several stories putting this motif into a stage. Now, construction of gender in mythology is the next point of this presentation. So women have been ascribed an important place in the lives of the jinas. The mothers of the jinas are considered worthy of respect by Jain followers because these mothers are the ones who give birth to children who would become exceptional beings. Thus, they are the focus of praise in devotional songs, for instance. And further, Maru Devi, the mother of the first jina Rishabha, is said among Shvetambaras to have been the first human being who reached final liberation in this life while she was attending the preaching of her former son. The place of women in the jinas' lives is an element of the diverging positions among Shvetambaras and Digambaras in relation with the question of marriage. Rishabha, the first of the 24 jinas, is a distinct case. As the inventor of techniques and social institutions, among them marriage, he is said to have married two wives and has fathered a large number of children. This was to be more or less obvious because he was the first jina. If he had had no descendants, then there would have been no continuation of the Jain tradition, in fact. But otherwise, according to the Digambaras, none of the jinas did assume the responsibilities of a householder or king before becoming a monk. According to the Shvetambaras, on the other hand, the situation is more complex. Although all sources state the fundamental reluctance of future jinas to marriage, some did marry, while others did not. Those who had karmas with pleasure as its fruit, surviving in them, it is said, must destroy these karmas by pleasure precisely. Therefore, they should marry. Further, those among the jinas who married all fathered a son. As they were all of royal families, he was the heir of the kingdom they left when they entered religious life. But there is one notable exception to this pattern, and not the least as it relates to Mahavira. In Digambara sources, consistently with their position, Mahavira embodies the perfect ascetic and is shown a total celibate. In Shvetambara biographies, on the contrary, several features underline the key role played by women in his life. Complying with his parents' wish, the young Mahavira married Princess Yashoda. Their child was a daughter named Priyadarshana, pleasant to the sight, both in name and form. And Priyadarshana later married Jamali, who was Mahavira's nephew through his sister. This is an instance of cross-cousin marriage, a South Indian practice which has been a constant feature of family alliances in Western India. Now, both Priyadarshana and Jamali became mendicants, followers of Mahavira. But later on, Jamali wandered separately from him and became a famous dissident. At first, Priyadarshana and her group of nuns supported Jamali's faction, as one commentary says, because of delusion which is easily acquired by women and because of former affection. Whatever this comment, later on the occasion of an incident, Priyadarshana got before her eyes the proof that her husband was wrong and came back to Mahavira's fold after having made an atonement, while Jamali remained alone sticking to his dissident idea. This narrative construction, which makes Mahavira the father of a daughter and not of a son, and a daughter who contributes to endanger his prevalence before coming back to his fold, may be significant to express the important position a woman may have in the transmission and preservation of values. It may also show how a woman may be subject to bad influence and needs safeguards. The insistence on associating a female lineage with Mahavira is probably deliberate, as not only his daughter is mentioned, but in the same passage of the Kalpa Sutra, his granddaughter as well. All this without any particular comment. As far as I know, later commentaries do not expand on this either and do not see it as an issue, although this insistence is uncommon. But it may be read as a strategy meant to underline sectarian identity against the Digambaras and perhaps also against the Buddhists, since Gautama is said to be the father of a son, as is well known. In the construction of mythology, the place of women and femininity also intervenes in relation to the notion of Dinahood itself. It is here that the diverging position of Shvetambara and Digambara Jainism regarding women's ability to reach final liberation from rebirth as a woman intervenes fully. As is well known, this is one of the main differences between the two traditions. Misogynic prejudices are one factor in this process, but the main point is that total nudity is a prerequisite for attainment of emancipation. Rejecting clothes means rejecting possessions as a whole, and thus attachment to them. Nudity, however, is not acceptable in women because of the impurity of their body caused in particular by menstrual flow. This is, in brief, the Digambara position. The Shvetambaras, on the other hand, favor a spiritual understanding of non-attachment. Wearing clothes does not necessarily mean attachment to them or to any other object, and so they advocate that emancipation is the result of the destruction of karmic matter in the soul, which is the same in both men and women, independently of whether we have a woman or a man body. This has been a complex debate. Now, these theological debates on women and emancipation are mirrored in the treatment in myth of the 19th among the 24 jinnas, Malli, as the gender issue is central in this story. In agreement with their cardinal statement that somebody can reach emancipation only as a man, the Digambaras hold that Malli was a boy in the last incarnation, like all other jinnas. The Shvetambaras, on the contrary, state that in the last incarnation, Mali was born a girl. Mali's earliest Shvetambara biography is narrated in one of the canonical scriptures, and the inclusion of Mali's story in a canonical scripture is a statement in itself, in a way. Let me sum up this story very briefly. In her former birth, Mali was born as a boy, Mahabala, who became a Jain monk and practiced severe penance along with his six childhood friends. They all had an agreement that they would do exactly the same thing. But Mahabala wanted to outdo his friends secretly. So if his six friends observed one day fast, he would fast for 2 days. If they would keep a 2 day fast, he would fast for 3 days, and so on. At the same time, his ascetic life was perfect. The ambivalent character of this individual is summed up in the words of a 12th century writer as, because of penance mixed with deceit, he acquired women inclination karma, Sri Veda, and also the body making karma of a Tirthankara because he had observed devotion to the Arhats and other religious practices. So Mahabala is reborn as Princess Mali. She turns to ascetic life, takes initiation, and reaches omniscience on the same day, which is not the case with other jinas. Normally, there is a period of several years between initiation and reaching awakening or omniscience. During this interval, the jinas live as non-omniscient wandering mendicants, where their asceticism is challenged through tests. So in the case of Mali, there is no period as a wandering mendicant between the two events, and also no period of testing, which involves possible challenges to asceticism. This could be understood as a way, a discrete way to underline that Mali's spiritual advancement is very quick. It can also be seen as a way to avoid embarrassing situations which the narrative of a non-facing tests could have produced, the purpose being to demonstrate the ability of a woman to reach emancipation as a woman rather than to go into many details. One aspect of gender issues is the use of gender in language and in naming. Biographies of Mali are also significant from this angle. In classical Indian languages, words ending in short e form an ambivalent grammatical category as they include both masculines and feminines. So Digambaras, who consider Mali as a male all along, use the masculine term Mali and apply masculine epithets to the name. Shvetambaras, on the other hand, stress the female identity of this figure by writing the name as Mali with final long E, and thus have the name included in a grammatical category that only has feminine nouns. This at least for the time in the narration when Mali is a girl and a princess. As soon as she enters religious life, she is only referred to as Mali the Arhat, Mali the Jinnah, or Mali Natha, Lord Mali, like any other Jinnah. Thus, even among the Shvetambaras, the extension of Mali's femininity remains limited. Artistic evidence is also not conclusive. There is only one instance of a sculpture that could represent Mali as a female. It is this black stone statue from the 10th or 11th century, which shows a woman sitting cross-legged in meditation, with the palms of her hands on top of each other and a lotus flower atop them. The head is missing, but femininity is clearly shown by the breasts, of course, the morphology of the body, and also, in the back view, the long plait falling to the bottom of the back. The only sign that would suggest that this lady could be Mali is the water pot in a square on the pedestal, which is the emblem of this dinner. It is interesting to note that an author of the 14th century, a Digambara author, adduces the lack of images of Mali as a female as a proof that this Jinnah could not have been a female. And he says, For example, no one in the world has ever perceived the alleged femininity of the images of Lord Malli. On the contrary, those images are always depicted in masculine gender. The Lord under debate must be a man because he is never portrayed as a female in his images. This is like the images of Mahavira, which are well known to be male in the tradition of both parties. End of quote. Indeed, represented as stereotyped figures, Jinnas are either seated in the lotus pose, a position, or standing erect, in which case features of masculine gender are conspicuous. But this is to be seen as a representation by default, as it were. Jinnah images are conceived as material heads for meditation and thus show emancipated souls, not their physical features. One author who discusses the Digambara position regarding the impossibility of female emancipation remarks, the Siddhas are neither male nor female. This is echoed in modern perception. For example, an American scholar reports that when she asked what one of her female importants why Mallinatha's image looks like a man, this lady answered, "A Jinna is not really a man or a woman. A Jinna is beyond the specifics of its birth." Indeed, to Shvetambara Jains, Malli is valued as a Jinna, not as a women role model. And we could find an echo to this preoccupation in, for example, this passage from the Bhikkhuni Samyutta. What does womanhood matter at all when the mind is concentrated well, when knowledge flows unsteadily as one sees correctly into Dhamma? One to whom it might occur, I am a woman or I am a man, or I am anything at all, is fit for Mara to address. So there is, in such cases, no importance in the gender difference, because only the soul or the spiritual progress is important. As we saw, in some early Jain scriptures, the masculine gender is prevalent. In many cases, it seems to be used deliberately to promote the image of the male hero. But from the 9th century onwards, later Shvetambara commentaries seem to become sensitive to the issue, the grammatical issue, which they sometimes address. They underline that masculine is generic and that feminine is also to be implied even when masculine is used. Or, they say, in case feminine words such as Shravika, laywomen occur, they take care to prescribe that indeed they have to be treated on par with their male counterparts. For example, you see here one quotation. The lay follower should consider as worthy of recipients of generosity also the lay women and the nuns who possess qualities, because something sown in the fourfold Sangha as a whole gives a lot of fruit. Lay womanhood as a valid general concern is discussed with arguments, and people are warned not to use despising prejudices against women as a motivation for excluding them from respect. Using the Jain attitude of multiple viewpoints, these authors draw on exemplary women and clearly state, I quote, "There is no invariability in the fact that women only are full of bad points. The same is true of men, too. They are also very often seen to be cruel, unbelievers, ungrateful, and so on. And all that does not justify that great men be despised. Similarly, in the case of women, even if some of them are found to be full of bad points, there are also some who are full of good points. As a matter of fact, even though they are women, the Jinnah mothers are worshipped even by the highest gods and praised by the best sages because of the importance of their qualities." So, thus the Jain tradition about women shows that indeed women are an important concern, both negatively and positively, and that multivocality is the key word. And here I close with a slide showing you a few examples of books which put more focus on today's Jainism and today's nuns or lay women. But why I selected these books, one reason is that some of them are quite recent, and another reason is that we can indeed read together some old stories, some old texts, and also the interviews or the viewpoints of nuns or Jain wives or ladies as they are given today. Even if there have been a lot of changes in the Jain community or among Jain women, there are still some points of view which can be echoed both in the past and in the present. So with this, I thank you very much for your patience, and I conclude. Thank you.
Do you have some questions for us?
Yeah, so Bhikkhu Analayo says, regarding the representation of Malli, slide 28-29, should she not have been without hair, having plucked them out instead of having a plait? Well, this is of course a point, but you see representation of other dinas, they are not necessarily shown without hair. For example, Rishabha is often shown with quite a number of locks of hair, and in other cases of sculptures also, it is not necessarily they are not necessarily seen without any hair. But of course, this statue which I showed, I mean, could be Malli. This is a statue which is often found in secondary literature, and could be Malli, but there is nothing sure about the identification.
I am struck by the difference between the story of Kalaka, says Arya Sudhama Bhikkhuni, rescue of the nun in distress, compared with stories from Pali Canon and commentary, where renunciates show their goodness by ignoring the distress of their renunciate sisters. The Bodhisattva said he had no relation to his former wife who had gone forth with him when men wanted to take her away, and they took her. Mahakasapa parted from his former wife at a crossroads, leaving her alone on the road, and more.
Well, in the sense, in the story of Kalaka, what is important is that Kalaka is a monk, and the lady who is abducted is also a nun. That means both are mendicants. So it is the question of solidarity between members of the monastic community, and also, as I tried to emphasize, and like as Mary also emphasized last week, the problem is that if there is a problem affecting one member of the monastic community, whether it is a nun or whether it is a monk, it affects the whole community. So it is not so much a kind of psychological benevolence or moral virtue or anything like that, than the concern about the welfare of the whole group, and the fact that the Jain community should not be endangered or blamed by the outside society if something happens to one of its members.
Do the jinnas have the same canonical male-only lakshanas that Buddhas have?
Yes, actually yes, there are many parallels between the lakshanas as they are described for the Buddha, and the lakshanas as they are described for Mahavira, standing for all the jinnas. And yes, they have the same male-only lakshanas.
And in Simile of the Saw, the Buddha said that even if the nuns were struck with a stick, the monks would give up ideas of the household life.
Yes, I mean the nuns should be protected. The nuns should be protected, and they should be protected by the teaching, but also by the monks, actually.
Yes. Yes, actually we have to be cautious with what we find in Jatakas. I mean, one could say that in Jatakas there are many things which are not Buddhist, because as Bhikkhu Analayo says, I mean, the narratives belong to the common stock of Indian narratives. The situation is different with the Jain canonical narratives, which are much more Jain in their own character, even if they also may draw at times from the folklore or from the general Indian environment. Yeah. So Aya Sudhamma Bhikkhuni, I am not sure I get your point exactly. Could you please help me to understand it better? Okay, thank you. Yes, I Bhikkhu Analayo, I totally agree with you. I mean, the stories of kidnapping of nuns, I think, reflect the precariousness of women living a celibate life in the ancient Indian setting, and thus explain the restrictive rules we find in both Buddhist and Jain monastic traditions for nuns. I agree with that. And as Mary explained also last week, I mean, if there are more rules for nuns, it is not only, I mean, to show that they are subordinate to monks or that they are not so good as monks or anything like that, but it is also because the main statement is that they need more protection than monks. And the story like the one of Saraswati in the Kalakacharya Katha story, I mean, shows an example of how nuns could be living dangerously, just being a nun in the Indian environment. Yes, I mean, Bhikkhu Analayo says that regarding the foundation of the order of nuns in the Buddhist tradition, given that otherwise the Buddhist and Jain traditions seem similar in their attitude, is the fact that we do not get negativity regarding the creation of a Jain order of nuns simply because we do not have an account of the foundation of their order, since according to hagiography, previous Jainas always had nun disciples, or do you see a principally different attitude here when comparing the Buddhist and the Jain traditions? Yes, that is actually a very interesting question. Well, I think it's very difficult to solve because, as you said, there is no real account of the founding of nun orders. But, I mean, the idea which the Jains want to transmit is that that nuns were always there. So there is no need of a special story about the foundation of the nuns order, as there is no special need for a story regarding monks' order. So it is always given in the Jain tradition as a fact, which was always there, and there is no story regarding the foundation of this order. But it is, in fact, it is puzzling, and I am not sure that there is so much difference actually between the Buddhist and the Jain attitudes, because when we see a text such as the Acharanga Sutra first section, which I mentioned in my talk, where only the masculine gender is used, and in a part of which the idea which they want to convey is the idea of the male hero, so I am not so convinced. I mean, probably Jains would not very much agree with me, but I am not totally convinced that the Jains were basically so different than the Buddhists in their general outlook. But the main difference is that the nuns are given as some component which was always there, and so there is no need of any justification or any special narration about them. Regarding the extra clothing worn by Jain nuns, my first thought was that it would be so painfully hot. Do nuns take this on as an heroic ascetic practice of sorts? Well, actually, you know, they have no choice. They have to wear all this clothing. And, I mean, it is clear in the text that, they have a clothing which is much thicker and much, made of more components than the monks. But it may be felt as a kind of supplementary penance, but it is actually the ordinary outfit of a nun. How is spiritual advancement shown? Short of full moksha. Apart from moksha, what is the spiritual advancement actually? So actually there is a full scale of different levels in spiritual advancement. So for example, it is a scale which is called gunasthana, a kind of a scale of different levels. There are 14 among them. And only the 14th, the highest, is full moksha. But there are many intermediate stages which you can climb. It's represented as a kind of ladder which you can climb. For example, as a lay person, you can climb by abstaining from different things which are prohibited and so on, and taking the minor vows of the layman. And then by doing that, you reach correct faith, and then you can progress, and then later on if you become a monk or a nun, then you progress like that on the scale until you reach moksha. But normally this takes, of course, a very, very long time. That means time which is spread along many births. So it is only in some very specific cases that somebody can attain moksha in this very existence. Do nuns typically attain to high levels related to male monks? Yes, they can attain to high levels. Like male monks, or sometimes even higher. And this is a trend which is interesting to follow in contemporary Jainism. That there are now many Jain groups, monastic groups, where the nuns are given much more place and much more higher status than they used to have. And I think that the general trend in the Indian society or in the general environment about progressive status among women in general will also affect and has started affecting nuns and the views of the Jain groups about nuns. But although there are many differences according to the groups, there are still a lot of groups where nuns, for example, do not have so much access to education or to scriptures. They are more or less confined to kind of daily works like stitching or copying and things like that, without necessarily being able to have access to a real education like monks. So there are differences among various monastic orders. May higher attainment Jain nuns provide teaching to Jain male monks? Well, there are examples in the past, although very, very few, of nuns. There is one nun who is called Yasini Mahattara, in the 8th century. Unfortunately, we do not know much about her, but she is supposed to have been a teacher to Haribhadra, who was a very famous Jain author, and who says that he was a kind of disciple of this nun. But there are very isolated examples. There is some speculation that before the Buddha established the bhikkhuni orders, some of the future Buddhist nuns lived in Jain nunneries. Does this sound likely to you? Well, I don't know. It's very difficult to answer this question. Actually, you know, for example, in the beginning, I quoted the example of Bhadda Kundala Kesa, who was a former Jain and who then converted to Buddhism, I mean, according to the Therigatha poem. I have not been able so far to find any example of the reverse, or in the I have not been able to find in Jain scriptures examples of nuns, you know, who would have been Buddhists and who would have lived along with Jain nuns. That, this is not very an easy question. It's a very interesting question, but the answer is very difficult to give. Is there any Western nun among Jain nuns in India, as far as you know? That's an interesting question. No, you know, it's not like in Buddhism. There is no Westerner among Jain monks or among Jain nuns who would be a monk or a nun permanently. But there is one Jain monastic order who is called the Therapant, who started in the 18th century and which is very alive nowadays. And they have introduced a new category. They have introduced this category in the 1980s, a category which they call Samanas and Samanis. And among the, in this category of people who are nuns and monks but with less restrictions than real monks and nuns, there have been some examples of Westerners temporarily staying with them. But this is the only thing which is allowed. There is no example, so far as I know, of any Westerner among Jain nuns or among Jain monks in India, as we have in the case of Theravada Buddhism, for example. Is it due to the closed nature of Jain communities overall? In a way, yes, yes. Because there are very strict rules, and because also the attitude towards the idea of conversion is probably more restrictive than in Buddhism or in other religions. So this could explain the fact that there are no Jain monks or Jain nuns, I mean, who are Westerners. So I think somebody is typing a message. Yeah. In English, the term fourfold Sangha with regards to Buddha's Chaturparisha is widely, but perhaps incorrectly used. I was interested that this is the correct term in Jainism with regards, yeah, the Jain Chaturvidha Sangha, I mean, is used, this term is used very often, and it refers to the four components. And it is used also in early texts. So thank you very much for this comment. So perhaps if there is no other question in process, well, thank you to all of you, and thank you to Bhikkhu Analayo for having invited me to participate in this series of lecture. I enjoyed, so far I enjoyed very much listening to the preceding lectures, and I am looking forward listening to the next ones too, because I think this series of lecture is very illuminating and very nice. Thank you very much.
Recording is off.
Recording is off.